Welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. And in studio with me today is Allie and Lauren Harrison of Paradise Valley Orchard in Paradise, Utah. And, you know, one of the things I've always wanted to talk about on this program, and just kind of never got around to doing it, was apple cider and how good apple cider really is. I want to find out from you, why did you buy this farm? How did you get into it? And why do you continue doing apple cider?
Well, it kind of fell into our laps. We had a little farm in Hiram, and we knew we wanted to expand at some point. And kind of Lauren's dad is a realtor, so we ended up, he saw this place. He's like, oh, there's a great place for sale. You guys should check it out. And we went and looked at it, and we were like, this is amazing. This is so cool. We knew nothing about apples. We knew how to farm. We've gardened, and we used to do the Logan Farmers Market. But we just saw this place based on the land and the location and all the stuff that came with it. We were like, this place is amazing.
So how quick from being notified to all of a sudden being owners and finding yourself with an apple cider press, how quick was it?
Quick. I think we bought it in February, moved in March, and we already were having calls about apples in May. So
wow.
It went fast.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, okay, and how long ago was that? 3-4 years ago?
We bought it in 2010.
Oh, okay.
So we've been there 4 years.
So you're old hands at it now.
Oh, yeah. We're pro.
What do you like about the business?
The public part is nice. It's nice having the public come out and letting people know where their food comes from. And we had no idea what we were getting ourselves into when we took over the place, but it was a crash course in public relations and pressing cider and understanding cider. And here we are.
Any surprises?
Lots, every day. Apples are a lot more difficult when you have a lot more of them than just the few in your backyard.
What were some of the things that surprised you when you first got in? You said you didn't know how to do apple cider before, and I'm assuming the previous owners were really helpful about showing you how to do things?
Yeah, they were amazing. I don't think we could have done it had we not been given all the instruction and direction from them. We knew how to farm. We knew how to garden. We were longtime avid gardeners, and we've dealt with fruit trees. But again, at our other place, we had one apple tree. Now we have 250. And that's just that learning curve of like, oh, this is an actual farm. This is a business. We were running a business. That part was hard. The gardening part was fun. Like, we love that. But doing the orchard and the cider pressing, and we have a little farmer's market out there, a little store that we stock with veggies and produce and cider, like just getting all of that up and running. And most of it we have just done kind of, we initially got a lot of instruction from the owners, but now we're like, well, let's do it. And we've kind of branched out and we've done more produce and stuff. So we do the apples and the cider, but we're also doing produce starting in like May. I was selling produce. So that's been really fun too on that end of it.
So I'm going to ask the big question, what's the difference then between apple juice and apple cider?
Apple juice is generally, but not always pasteurized, but it's always filtered.
So it's filtered, it's gone through a cloth, so it's taken out all the little particulates
right,
that are
right.
in it?
Right, they go through a very fine filter. And often it's a blend of whatever apples are, say, seconds from the larger orchards.
And do you have to... Can you have unpasteurized apple juice as well?
I don't think that you can. Most apple juice is prepackaged on the shelves, so it's shelf stable, so it's being canned, processed.
You can go into the store, and typically I think the large grocers have to sell. I mean, they have the apple cider, they have the apple juice, but even the cider has been pasteurized?
Yes. Anything sold outside of the farm that actually presses the cider has to be pasteurized at this time.
I know for my taste buds, I much prefer unpasteurized. Just the flavor is better. Do you know why that is?
They say that it's because of the enzymes, but there's many disputes that using ultraviolet treatment, so-called cold pasteurizing, but it's not truly pasteurizing. It kills less of the enzyme and retains more of the flavor, but there's a lot of people that truly believe that unpasteurized cider has more of everything in it.
So what is the process that someone has for getting their apples pressed? Is it still the way that it used to be, that people brought their apples to you and then maybe their own jugs or buy the jugs from you, and then they just press their apples together, or is it, how does it work?
So what we do, we schedule up someone's press, so they'll call and they'll tell us we have 20 bushels of apples or whatever they have. They'll call, make an appointment, because it's packed scheduling. It's crazy how tightly scheduled we are.
And how far in advance do you have to call and get that scheduled?
Well, as of this morning, most of our Saturdays have been booked now. It depends. We do have people cancel, and then I can slide you in. We've never really had to turn away people, because if it turns out that we've got a ton of people and we have filled up our days, we will just press a little earlier or a little later. Like, we'll fit them in.
And so you just do it on Saturdays, or do you do it during the week?
No, we do it during the week.
Okay.
Yeah. So if people, we have some diehard people that have been pressing for 20 years that always press the second weekend in October, and we got those calls in like July to reserve their spot. But most people will just tell me how many bushels they have, and then I'll just slide them in somewhere. And that's kind of how the scheduling part works. People will bring their apples in, we put them on the scale, and then it goes into a grinder. And the grinder just basically makes it into applesauce. And then from the grinder, there's a big hose, and we press it out. It's called a rack and cloth system. So you take this big tube of applesauce, and you're basically squeezing it out into a giant canvas, which acts like a cheesecloth, and you fold it up, and then you put a board on it, and you keep doing that till you have about 10 stacks is what fits in our press. It depends on the size of your press, how many high you can go, and then we slide it under a hydraulic press, and this press will squeeze it down. The pressure just squeezes the stack into a tiny little sandwich. And then from that, the juice comes out of the cloth in like these little rivers, and all of it's caught underneath in a big stainless steel tank. And then from that tank, we have another little pump that pumps it into a jug filler. So then that will fill the jugs with this big tank with two spigots, basically. So that's kind of the process. So yes, to answer your question, the people who bring their apples in, that's the cider that they get. They just basically watch us do it, and then they can fill up their truck with 30 gallons of cider and drive off.
This is the Zesty Garden. I'm talking with Allie and Lauren Harrison of Paradise Valley Orchard, and we're talking about apple cider. Backing up to the appointments, I would think in a year like this where the summer's been cooler, and it's like my galas, which are normally pickable by Labor Day, I'm leaving them on there another week because they're still weren't quite developed. So if you schedule your appointment too far ahead, I could imagine it's just they're not going to taste as good.
Yeah, and it does depend on the variety. Some varieties you can get a month of storage almost at room temperature. Other varieties you can get 2 weeks out of. Other varieties you have to put in the fridge. So a lot of it's just variety to variety. A lot of people in the valley have all kinds of root cellars and basements and garages. So we just tell people, they run into that where they'll have their galas ripe, or their the early varieties are ready to go now, and then but they want to add in their Red Delicious, which aren't ready until like the end of October. So they're like, okay, what do we do? And we just say, you know, store them the best that you can, keep them cold. And then the day that you pick those Red Delicious, we're going to try to schedule you. And then sometimes you'll run into where their first apples are not good enough to put in the mix. But we just try to accommodate that where we can.
So it's a pretty busy couple of months.
Yes.
For you guys, I could imagine.
Extremely.
Because apples are coming on. Now, we'll get into the types of apples, but I mean, apples start coming on as early as the end of July, depending on the variety. As far as a batch is concerned, how many pounds of apples or bushels does it take for one batch for the pressing?
So the minimum that can fit through the machine is we try to do it in 10 bushel stacks. Each time we spread out basically that apple pomace, that applesauce.
Yeah, I had visions of one of those Play-Doh squeezers. I mean, you've got this thing and it's
kind of, yeah,
pushing it out.
That's
okay.
Kind of what it is. So one of those is a bushel. So, and we try to do about 10 through the machine is what fits. That's the prime weight for the hydraulic press to push the most juice out. It just works better when we can do it in 10 bushel batches. So the minimum is 10 bushels that people bring out with.
Yeah, so if somebody comes and they don't have 10 bushels, do you just put two people together? And so you have this blend of apples that are from your tree and maybe another customer that came in?
We've sold bushels to people. If someone brings in eight, you know, we've sold them a bushel or two to make it to get to the 10. But most of the time, I just tell people when they're on the phone making the appointment with me, I just tell them, see if you've got a neighbor. I mean, how many times have you driven past trees with apples just falling on the ground? And when I tell people that, like, oh, call a neighbor, call a friend, see if there's anyone that has a couple laundry baskets of apples that you can just meet that minimum. And most of the time, everyone can. People will generally make the minimum.
So I'm not sure who to ask about this question as far as the apples themselves. So you don't have any control over how people are harvesting their apples or how they take care of them, rinse them, you know, spray them, whatever. So as far as health regulations, I mean, there were a couple of scares there in the 90s where all of a sudden the USDA stepped in and said, well, unless you're the kind of the local mom and pop place, you have to pasteurize everything. So these are not pasteurized. It's not juice that's being pasteurized. So how do you control the cleanliness of the apples that's coming in? One of the things I was reading about was what they called windfall apples, apples that had fallen on the ground. So if people are bringing a lot of those in and they happen to be in a pasture where there are cows or the deer come through, so the concern is E. coli. How does that get taken care of in the unpasteurized process?
Well, that's kind of a tough question. We've set pretty strict standards for people to bring their apples in. We require them to be washed. We require them to be apples that you would actually eat. We do not allow windfalls. It all comes down to cleanliness because we're providing a service for other people. We're not actually supplying juice. When we do our press for our business, we press first. We never press after anything else, because we cannot guarantee exactly, you know, what goes in. So we set pretty strict standards on what goes through our machines, and everything is cleaned, everything is washed every night.
Do you have to go through the apples that are coming in and just kind of look at them?
We do.
You can see if that they've been taken care of.
Yes, you can see.
We've
turned people away.
If their apples are rotting, it's like, why are you going to make juice out of this? Who wants to eat that, let alone drink that juice? So we have turned people away, and they know that. And I think for the most part, people will follow the rules. They know that it's a pretty special thing that we have. There's not a lot of custom pressing operations. And so people want to follow the rules, and they do a good job. For the most part, everyone brings in really nice apples. We've got people that bring in bushels of apples, and each apple has been hand washed and hand dried. But it's those people that you don't want to ruin it for the rest of the people who are picking them off the ground or, you know, bringing in these rotten things. So we do have to set a pretty strict standard of what we accept. So the rule with unpasteurized cider is that it just has to be sold from the farm. So unless we were to pasteurize, we cannot take it and sell it anywhere but the farm. So Utah still allows unpasteurized cider to be sold from the farm stand.
And even though it's not your apples, it becomes, because they're bringing it to your farm and you're selling it back to them as juice.
Yes, we get around that because we're providing a service. It's a service that we provide. The other thing is we make people sign a waiver. It basically says you are aware that this is unpasteurized cider. This is not canned cider that sits on the shelf. This is not apple juice that's shelf stable. It needs to be drank within this many days. It needs to be frozen. And you basically agree to these terms. And so we kind of did that to cover our own butts, basically, about, you know, just to make sure that if someone does bring in a bad batch of apples that we happen to press, they realize what they're getting into.
Okay, well, let's get right into the question. So then what makes good apple cider? What varieties of apples? I've read that the earlier apples that come on, the more soft summer type apples, they're not so good, but the harder the apple is, usually the better the flavor. But you also want to have a mixture.
You generally want a mixture. Red Delicious don't make a fantastic cider all by itself, but it, you know, it's a viscous enough, sweet enough juice that added to something, say Jonathan or something like that, it adds enough, you know, as long as you keep it. We try to do a mixture of, say, thirds was what we were taught when we first took it over, and we've kind of played with that a little bit on some of the apples, but a mixture of thirds of, say, your sweets, your aromatics, and, you know, some of the more acidic, sharper types.
Okay, I'm going to pinpoint you down. So what makes a sweet apple? I'm assuming that a Gala would be considered
a
sweet.
Gala is a very sweet apple.
And you wouldn't want to have juice that's straight Gala because it would just be too sweet.
It would be pretty sweet, but in the end, it still comes out to be pretty good juice. We've tried a lot of juice, and we've worried about a lot. We've actually had people press slightly underripe Red Delicious apples that I thought would be awful, and it wasn't, you know, it didn't have a lot of character to it, but it was apple juice.
Okay.
And but the sweeter apples, you definitely want to, I like it a little bit tartar. We both like it a little bit on the tartar side. Jonathan is something we really like to have in every batch that we do.
So any of the Jonathan strains or just straight Jonathan?
Straight Jonathans we like, but there's a lot of the good Jonathan strains out there too. We've had some that were younger trees that are just starting to produce that are like a Jonifree. They've got some disease resistance. Great tree. Great tasting apple. Good hard apple a little bit later, kind of a middle season. But we've had some really good luck with some of the aromatics, the early apples, like the Williams Prides and the Red Freeze. Those do pretty well. Pristines are a good apple too, but they're almost too early. They're kind of hard to get anything to mix with them.
So the aromatics are one that you're calling the early season apples.
Yeah. Well, most of the early ones seem to be a little aromatic. I'm not saying that as a blanket statement.
What about the old heirloom varieties? If you can grow something like an Ashmead or a Pippin, I've heard that those aren't so great for eating, but they're really good for putting in cider.
Mm-hmm. Some of those, like the Ashmead's considered to be one of the finest dessert apples to eat, but it's got a very complex juice, so it would probably be fine standalone. Crispin's, the late apples, are fantastic apple on its own, all by itself, just a single varietal cider does well.
Some of the old English varieties were bred specifically just for cider, and they're like those old heirloom types. And if you, from what I've read, we don't have a lot of them at our orchard. We've talked about getting some of those really cool, unique old English varieties. But what I've read is some of them you can hardly even bite into without spitting it out. But yet it makes the most craziest, awesomest juice you've ever had from these strange old varieties. Like, a lot of them have that crab apple taste. Mm-hmm. Crab apples are something that actually go pretty good in cider, too. They add that mouthfeel, they call it, and the skin. Sometimes if they have a bitter skin, that bittering agent in the skin adds that complexity, that character, that's not just drinking straight sweet juice, you know, that makes it interesting.
This is the Zesty Garden. I'm talking with Allie and Lauren Harrison of Paradise Valley Orchard, and we're talking about apple cider. So adding some of these older varieties back in can be a really good thing.
They are coming in. There's a lot of those old varieties that they're finding again. In fact, there's one that's from the United States that's called a Harrison cider apple. Since our last name's Harrison, we decided we should at least have a couple of those and see how they turn out. And it's a hard cider apple that is also very good in sweet cider. And it's a single varietal. Like, it can be made into a sweet cider by itself or a hard cider by itself. We sell juice to a lot of people that actually make hard cider. We don't make hard cider for market, but we do sell the juice to people that are going to use it strictly for making hard cider. It's become very popular, actually.
I think it was one of my editions of Organic Gardening, and there was an article about some of these heirloom varieties, and the guy talked about maybe it was American Heritage Magazine. Anyway, he was looking for a Reaser Green, and he did all this research, and nobody had it until he found one reference to some farm, and I think it was in Virginia, and he was able to track it down. And there's like one or two trees by the side of a road that the farmer's like, oh yeah, there used to be an orchard there, and they were able to get some scion cuttings of it, and now they're propagating it again. So I'd love to put one of these in my own garden. So going to my next question then is, and you alluded to this just a little bit, Allie, was adding other fruits into the juice. How easy is that to do at your operation? So if I have apples, but I want to throw in some, I don't know, some gooseberries or something, or some raspberries, can you do that?
Well, it always sounds amazing. People have they always ask us, like, oh, I've got pears. A lot of times pears come on with apples, and it sounds so good. We're like, oh, that would be so cool if we could do that. But our machine is not capable of doing that. The claws that we have right now, these big canvasy, it's like a canvas, kind of picture like a Carhartt material. That's what it is. These claws only, they're specifically designed for apples only. Mm. And so those other fruits, they don't have the same pulp that apples
yeah,
do.
Yeah, and apples are a lot... I would think a lot more thick.
Yeah.
So these other fruits might just go yeah. right through that cloth.
And it would just be a kind of a thick, gooey mess. So if you want to add different juice, what we tell people is add it after. Like, we'll give you the apple part, and then it's up to you to juice your berries and your pears, and then you can always blend that in after.
Well, let's talk about some of the uses of apples. So what I like is that it can be used as a sweetener. What are the things have you done with your apple cider?
With the cider or mm-hmm. just the apples?
No, with the cider.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love to do a lot of canning. So at the end of the season when we've got a ton, I'll throw it in the canner and do a bunch, put it in jars. And so that way that's essentially pasteurizing it, canning it, and we put it on the shelf.
How does that compare?
It tastes like apple juice from the store.
Okay.
That's what I think. It's kind of comparing like a fresh peach versus a canned peach. Like, there's a huge difference. The canned peach is still good and it lasts forever, so it's got, you know, the benefits of you storing it in a pantry as opposed to in a freezer or whatever. But that's what it does. The heat, when you heat it up and you boil it and whatever, it turns it into apple juice. It's good. It's wonderful. I like to, I cook with it all the time. Like, I'll reduce it down into kind of a syrup and glaze roasts with it and do all kinds of stuff. I marinate things in it. But I like to do that with the end of our cider. If we're completely sick of it. I get sick of cider like about 3 weeks in. I'm like, no more cider, no more apples. So, but I do like to do a lot for the pantry. We can it. And then the apple cider syrup is really popular. You can take either the fresh apple cider or canned, and you boil it down into the syrup for pancakes, waffles.
Just straight? You don't have to add anything to it?
I think there's recipes online. You can add honey, maple syrup. You can add things, and it comes out really, really good. So,
well, I know someone gave me some choke cherry syrup. The same thing. They had to add with choke cherries, of course, some sugar to it, but boiled it down
yeah.
to the syrup. That it's really good
yeah.
on pancakes. So I'd imagine the same thing with the apples
yeah.
would be really good.
You can boil the straight cider down, and it actually does a decent job of. You can come up with a decent syrup just on its own.
Hmm.
But I like to add cinnamon and spices and all kinds of stuff to it.
I know I was reading online that, you know, apples are kind of like a mild laxative, so you can use that to be regular all through the winter season. If you're using the apple cider, vitamin C, of course, big, so that's a great winter source for vitamin C. So let's talk about storage. So you talked about canning is one way to do it, or have a big freezer.
Freezing is generally what most people do with it. As soon as you can get it into a freezer, some people actually like to let it sit for a day or two and let it kind of mellow.
Let it develop a little bit.
Just a little bit, and then freeze it. And freezing it comes out of the freezer almost as good as when it went through the press.
And is there an issue with how long you can keep it frozen?
Generally, we recommend people to, like, keep it a year.
I don't think it would last that long at my house, to be honest. You know, for us, it's been mostly the space limitations and how many can we actually put in.
I always tell my husband, we need to go in the freezer business. We'll sell you, you know, we'll book these presses and then sell you a freezer on the side.
I'm sure we've drummed up a little business for some of the local appliance dealers in town.
And, you know, one of my last questions, I've always wondered, so are you picking through each one of these apples as they come in, or is there a possibility there might be a little bit of, shall we say, protein that's also in the apple juice or apple cider?
When I dump it in the grinder, I'm looking for that stuff. And you can kind of see when someone comes in with apples and you're like, I don't know. I'll dump a box in the grinder, and as it's going up, I'm digging through it, looking for stuff. And then we've actually had to just stop it and say, you know what, this isn't going to work. You can tell. I mean, one apple in a 10-bushel batch isn't going to do anything, but when most of the apples are not acceptable, we're like, yeah, we're going to.
Yeah, and by this time of year anyway, even if there is an apple there that has a wormhole in it, like maybe they went through the blossom in and you don't see it.
Yeah.
They're not actually in the apple
right.
anymore.
They took a bite and then they left.
But it does actually leave, it'll leave mold inside of the core. And that's more the issue, I think, than the little bit of protein. That would be the more worrisome thing. And then the next year, people are a lot more, if you turn somebody away and they still want their apples pressed, the next year their apples are beautiful.
Mm. And then they're proud of it. They're like, look how good we did this year. And we're like, yay.
So the rule of thumb is to have at least, did you say 10 bushels?
Yeah, 10 bushels is our minimum.
And have them in thirds. So have them, some of the sweeter varieties, a third of them sweet, a third of them the more tart, and then a third, if you can, the more aromatic.
Yes.
That would make the ideal cider. Like Lauren said, we have people that press straight Golden Delicious or straight Red Delicious, and it's fine. But if you want, you're paying for the cider, you want it to be the best that you can, then yeah, definitely the more apples you can put in, the better.
I was just thinking of what my Honeycrisp would taste like if they were juiced, because I adore Honeycrisp, and I've been picking them off the tree probably a little bit early, but they've been so good. But I love that sweet tart.
Honeycrisps are amazing. We were just talking about that today, the high demand for Honeycrisp, and we had people calling in June about our Honeycrisp. It's like, they're crazy. We should charge $20 an apple.
And you see how much they are in the store. So when I ate this one this morning, that was, because there weren't a lot on my tree this year, and it's about 5 inches across. This apple was just humongous. I thought, I wonder how much that would be. Yeah. I'd be charged for that in the store. Probably at least a buck an apple.
At least, so, yeah.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden, and Allie and Lauren Harrison of Paradise Valley Orchard have been my guest. Thank you for coming into the program.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Welcome to this segment of Going Native, where we talk about native and drought-tolerant plants that you should consider growing in your own garden. I'm with Jeanette Warner, and she's owner of Wildland Nursery, just south of Richfield in Joseph. And this one is Helenium hoopsii?
Yes, Helenium hoopsii.
And it's the Orange Mountain Daisy, or Orange Sneezeweed. How did it get that name?
Looking through all of my research material, the one I liked the best was, it goes back to when they used it as snuff.
Really?
Yeah, the seeds are, the pollen is snuff.
Okay, my mouth's open here. So how would they use that as snuff?
Well, probably if you've ever worked out in the garden and it's dusty and you've got these flowers that are gone to seed and you start pulling them up, you get that dust in your nose and you start sneezing.
Is this considered to be a plant that would be hard for those that have allergies?
No more than any other plant that produces.
This one, it's easy how?
It doesn't take any care. It will grow anywhere. It grows in full sun, shade, any soil. With a lot of water, it gets really big and nice. Without any water, it just stays smaller. It blooms a long time. And this is another one that blooms really early, like starts blooming April, May, when the blue flax is blooming. And the firecracker penstemons are starting to come on. And so you have that real pretty primary color scheme again.
And how long does it bloom?
With this extra water, it'll bloom for a month and a half.
Wow.
It's no short blooming. And I found out, too, you cut them back and they will bloom again.
Oh, good. But if you have this in an area where, like, I have a segment between my driveway and the neighbor's driveway that I just don't want to water at all. Mm-hmm. This would be one that I could put in that section that would do okay with whatever Mother Nature provides?
I think that'd kind of be stretching it a little bit, because to look its best, it needs
just a little bit
of water, yes.
Okay. Visually, how tall does it get?
2.5 feet, and it forms these candelabra-like stems and all these bunches and bunches of flowers are on the end of these. It's like candles on top of a candelabra, and it's quite striking. And they're just so, in the early spring, they're just amazing.
And I would imagine the butterflies and the bees are probably all
yes,
over it.
Yes, yes.
When you talk about easy maintenance by deadheading it, so it'll reblossom?
Yes, it will reblossom, but it also reseeds. And I have an area in my garden that I just has basically let it take over, and it has, with the blue flax and the firecracker penstemon. So if you don't want that to happen, if you are the kind of gardener that likes to spend hours out there every day, you'll want to deadhead it.
And it looks like it's a somewhat large plant, 2 by 2 feet?
Mm-hmm, at least.
And tough, strap-like basil leaves. So what does a basil leaf look like? Is it something that's thinner?
The basil leaves are the ones closest to the ground. And you'd think, oh, that's tough. It acts like a ribbon almost, inch wide, kind of a grayish green, and you try to pull it or tear it. It's tough. It's a tough leaf.
Average soil, so that's
yep,
that's
the
good
same
for most
average
areas.
Soil.
Uh-huh. It says sun to partial shade.
Right.
So can I put this in a dry, shady area?
Yep. Yes. Uh huh.
Oh, you're just bringing all these good plants in.
And that's it. A lot of folks don't recognize these plants usable in these dry, shaded areas.
Medium to low water, mm-hmm. will flower longer with supplemental water. Zones 3 to 5.
Yes.
So that covers a lot of Utah. Best uses is including understory planting or wildflower meadow.
And what I mean understory is underneath the quaking aspen, underneath your big trees. Mine is underneath my white fir and my gamble oak. I have big tooth maple underneath all of those.
So it gets dappled light.
Right.
Is what's happening. Mm-hmm. Okay. And what would you pair this one with?
You talked about
the blue flax.
Yeah. What I said earlier was the blue flax, they bloom at the same time, and the firecracker penstemon work really well. They all bloom kind of at the same time.
Okay. And as far as getting it through the winter?
It dies back. It's herbaceous. It dies back to the ground.
And then just comes up again on its own?
Mm-hmm. In the spring, you'll want to go and clean it up, cut it back, cut off the dead stalks, whatever.
Okay. Well, we've been talking about the orange mountain daisy, also known as the orange sneezeweed. And Jeanette Warner is the guest I've had in today. She's owner of Wildland Nursery, just south of Richfield in Joseph. And you've been listening to our segment, Going Native. Thanks for coming in, Jeanette.
Thank you very much.
In our gardening calendar, the Tahnaquit Nature Center is holding a planting and planning workshop in St. George on Saturday, the 27th. During this workshop, plan your color scheme for the white winter months as we transition into winter. The Tahnaquit Nature Center is located at 1851 South Dixie Drive. Also on the 27th at Thanksgiving Point in Lehigh, they're holding a flower arranging class from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Come get in touch with your countryside and learn floral techniques while arranging flowers in a rustic planter. Information is at thanksgivingpoint.org. The USU Extension Office is holding a Food Sense cooking class on September 25th, 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at the Cache County Extension Office. Learn how to cook quick meals and use the produce you've grown, all while staying on budget. And the Vernal is holding their Ashley Valley Farmers Market on Saturdays from 8 a.m. to noon. It's at 150 East Main Street in Vernal. And then finally, this Saturday, beginning at 8 a.m., you'll see incredible skill and agility that will be demonstrated by Utah's best tree climbers at the Utah Community Forest Council's International Society of Arboriculture Utah Chapter's 21st Annual Tree Climbing Championship at Main Street Park at 8720 South 90 East in Sandy. The event showcases talents of the top 10 climbers from the 2012, 13, and 14 tree climbing events as they compete for the title of Utah champion. For more information, call Mike Merritt at 801-971-0795 or visit their website at UtahUrbanForest.org. Coming up next is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose with part 2 of Beatrix Potter's Love of Gardens.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. Once again, it pleases me to talk with you about Beatrix Potter and her gardens. I will be using a book by Marta McDowell called Beatrix Potter's Gardens, The Places and Plants That Inspired the Classic Children's Tales, which of course are the Peter Rabbit tales. As Beatrix grew and became an adult, she had people who helped her try to get the little book she was writing and illustrating for children published, and had quite a hard time finding a willing publisher, until at last she found a publisher who actually became her fiancé. She had written the tale of Peter Rabbit, and in Beatrix Potter's matter-of-fact voice, the garden is not sentimentalized. From page one, she takes off the white gloves, noting that Peter's unwise father had ignored his wife's good advice and ended up in a pie at Mr. McGregor's table. His wife's good advice should have been followed. Rabbits in most gardens were not pets like Peter Piper, Benjamin Bouncer, and all the rest. While Beatrix had been known to free a wild rabbit from a trap, she stated unequivocally, "They are regular vermin, but one cannot stand by to see a thing being mauled from one's friendship for the race." The country houses that the Potters occupied over the years had gardeners who would not have appreciated animal rights. Scottish gardeners were the norm, both north and south of the borders. Scotland was a known exporter of gardeners and botanists. Mr. McGregor was a type, and Beatrix knew the type up close. Her grandparents employed gardeners, as did the country house owners from whom her fathers let. In 1894, staying in Lanelle, yet another property in Scotland, she wrote about the ripening cherries in the tree in the garden, reporting that the rooks are so tame they will scarcely leave it for stone throwing. And the thrushes sit and stare at me. I have been tying up some bunches in little muslin bags and also weeding to the amusement of our old gardener. Beatrix wrote for the record that she never knew a gardener named McGregor, though several bearded horticulturalists have resented the name. He and Peter seem to have emerged fully clothed, as it were, their names especially to be inevitable. Beatrix Potter took memories of gardeners over the decades of country estate summers and came up with a composite character. Mr. McGregor was no special person unless in the rheumatic method of planting cabbages, she wrote. I remember seeing a gardener in Warwickshire extended full length on his stomach, weeding a carriage drive with a knife. So she had observed gardens and gardeners. And when she lost her fiancé, it was to gardens that she turned for comfort and solace. And so she bought a property called Hilltop Gardens and the homestead on it. She didn't live in it for a while, but she hired gardeners and she worked with them as she continued to write and illustrate the Peter Rabbit tales. The first Peter Rabbit tale was a surprise success. As a result, Beatrix went on to publish one or two books with Warren, that was her publisher, every year, arriving, as one reviewer put it, as much a manifestation of autumn as falling leaves. The tale of Squirrel Nutkin has its own falling leaves that the squirrels use as little boats to make their way to an island. Nutkin's rhymes highlight the trees, beech, oak, cherry, hazel, and crab, but its story is of the woodland, not the garden. Nor does the tale of Gloucester, set in a city shop, have anything to do with gardening, though the embroidery, deftly managed by mice, includes some exquisite flowers. It wasn't until the next Bunny book, The Tale of Benjamin Bunny, published in 1904, that the garden came again into play. Her little books brought Beatrix Potter out of her shell. Her letters from the period indicate strong relationships with friends and cousins, with her publisher, F. Warren and Company. She was assertive. About a possible new project, she wrote, "I cannot design pattern borders, but I like drawing flowers. I will go on with it on approval if you are undecided, or for myself if you decline it." Warren's was a family business. a large sociable clan, opened its arms to her. Norman was her project manager. She interacted with his older brothers, Furing and Harold, and his sister Millie welcomed her to their Bedford Square home, where they lived with their widowed mother. As time progressed, Beatrix's letters to Norman softened with playful and affectionate undertones. She gave Norman a nickname, Johnny Crow, and delighted in a little glass six-sided box he made for Hunka Munka in the star of The Tale of Two Bad Mice. And she wrote, "I don't know whether I shall get as far as a big landslip by myself," she confessed. "I have no one to walk with." She enjoyed his company as well as his professional advice. And of their latest project, The Tale of Mrs. Tiggywinkle, she wrote, "I do hate finishing books. I would like to go on with them for years." It appears it wasn't only the book she had in mind. Beatrix compared herself to Anne Elliot in Jane Austen's Persuasion, when on July 25, 1905, she received a letter from Norman asking for her hand. Her position changed from spinster daughter one day to cherished fiancée the next. She was in her 30s at this time. And so they became, as I said, engaged. But before they could marry, he died of leukemia. She and his sisters and brothers mourned for him. As a way to comfort herself, she bought the garden property. For 2 months after his death, she bought 34-acre hilltop farm, purchased with the royalties from her books, supplemented with a legacy from an aunt. And so gardening eases Beatrix's grief. It launched her into a pleasant distraction. She engaged in a local mason to move the entry drive away from the front door, giving her more space for beds at the front of the house. And she wrote, "The garden is very overgrown and untidy. I hope next time you come, it will be straighter." And so she takes great joy in gardening, and I took joy in reading her garden journals because I identify with her. A lot of the flowers she grew, I grew. For example, I brought to the station today 2 arrangements, and most all of the flowers in those arrangements are flowers that she grew. One in particular, Lunaria, which means moonflower. It's a translucent flower in which you can see the disc-like seeds. And Lunaria refers to the moon because it does look like a pale moon, and they grow in my garden. Well, it's been a wonderful romp for me, and I will spend one more time with Beatrix Potter's garden journals. Thank you for listening. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.